Welcome on to a Thursday night edition of the Dunked On Basketball Podcast. After two relatively predictably underwhelming TNT games, probably the best game was actually the non-TNT game, which was Grizzlies-Pacers, but I guess they have to get all the bad teams out of the way early on TNT before we know for sure that they're going to be bad. The Knicks kind of came back to earth today, wouldn't you say, Danny?
Yeah, they definitely came back to earth, and that's also what happens when you play a team that's closer to full strength that is a legitimate team.
Yeah, that Bucks team, you know, you'll see a lot of kind of weird results on opening night. I didn't watch a ton of that game, but as we noted yesterday, without Giannis, who's like in many ways the linchpin of what they want to do defensively, talking about the Bucks, with Jabari still out, you know, I don't see this Knicks team putting up a buck 22 on a good defense. So I wouldn't totally throw out last night, but I think tonight is a little bit more indicative of what we are probably going to see from this Knicks team.
Yeah, and I actually think that actually lies in, we asked for Twitter questions, and I think that one way of talking about this game is actually from a Twitter question, or a Facebook question, which was from Sean O'Brien, which asked if the Knicks can shoot well enough, considering their heavy doses of jump shooting, I would add in, you know, where they're shooting them from, to maintain a top 15 offense.
Yeah, and he noted the fact that it could be a fluke.
Yes.
And I believe that it probably is. I mean, who is a good shooter on this team? Jose Calderon, I guess, but he doesn't really have the juice to get his shot off much other than in, like, just pure spot-up situations. Derek Williams has had some nice moments in the preseason and in the first game, went back to earth a little bit today. Doesn't have that established track record. Porzingis, I think he's going to shoot like 35% on threes this year probably. And they're not really running a ton of stuff to get him threes either. Vujicic is going to fall out of the rotation pretty quickly, I would imagine. Langston Galloway, you know, another guy. I mean, some of these guys could be okay, but I don't see them as a below average shooting team ultimately.
And they don't have a ton of guys, at least at this moment, who can really create the spaces in a defense to get a ton of clean looks. Like, they'll get some, you know, they'll get a fair amount of them, but I don't think they're going to get a disproportionate amount of clean ones to make it that they're going to do better than their, let's say, their expected points per shot.
Yeah, you make a good point, too, that a lot of being a good shooting team is actually getting open for shots, which I don't think that they have a ton of penetration to do that. A few observations on this game, I didn't really watch that much of the second half of it because, you know, I think it was pretty much Atlanta comfortably ahead most of the time. Sasa Vujicic, the fact that he is starting for this team is pretty comical to me.
Yeah, that's definitely something there. And I mean, Calderon got roasted on defense too. They have a backcourt.
Yeah.
They have a backcourt right now that I wouldn't even say shouldn't be starting. They just shouldn't be playing that much because they're not at that level. And I was thinking watching this game about the idea of, you know, that for certain guys, obviously you want to kind of move players in natural progression. I would actually consider playing Calderon with the backups just because I think that's a better situation for him. And yeah, you're throwing presumably Langston Galloway a little bit into the fire, but I think that you would stand a better chance giving Calderon a good opportunity to succeed.
Well, I don't see why you wouldn't just start Langston Galloway at the two at this point.
That's another option,
I mean,
too.
Vujicic, you know, granted, okay, he knows the triangle. Phil Jackson has this kind of weird loyalty, which has paid off in some respects. A lot of other respects, it has not. And I think this will be one of the latter situations. He was 2 out of 8 today, 2 out of 6 on threes, and just got destroyed by Kyle Korver, who was 6 for 8, 15 points. I mean, Kyle Korver even blew past him for a layup at one point, which basically never happens. And, you know, obviously with Lopez not being a guy who's going to step out very far, Porzingis being inexperienced, not knowing the personnel, you know, he wasn't getting any favors from the bigs but, you know, there are a lot of those emergency Korver situations that were created, and Vujicic was not really able to stop them the way a lot of the great defenders were able to do in the playoffs last year to Korver.
Would you, I know we talked about this before the season, but considering they also have Kyle O'Quinn, do you think that Porzingis is a substantially better fit with the second unit than the first unit? Because while I think it is true conceptually, I think it's also would be good for him to get those reps against more, I guess you could say, more beatable, more exploitable opponents early on, just to build up his confidence and get him integrated into the flow.
Yeah, maybe you could say that Porzingis should get some more minutes as a backup center, which we, of course, I think both think is ultimately his best position, and may even be against backups where he's not going to have to deal with too much muscle a lot of times in his matchup. But they also don't really have another backup center available right now with Kevin Seraphin out. So really, O'Quinn was kind of needed in that role. And he's been great. Six offensive rebounds in this game. He was really good last night as well. So maybe you could say that he should start, but he's not really much of a power forward either, and this is probably going to be a shooting challenge lineup. I mean, I do think if you're going to start Calderon and Vujicic together, that then maybe Porzingis' shooting isn't as necessary, because the one thing that those guys at least theoretically can do is shoot, although they couldn't tonight. Calderon was 0 for 5. I don't know. What did you think of Porzingis in this game?
I thought he was inconsistent, but that's what you'd expect from a young guy. He has the kind of the confidence to take some of those shots. People have talked a lot about the spin move, which was gloriously awkward, which I enjoyed a lot. But
yeah, that wasn't like some like awesome, I can't believe his agility in the open court. It was barely saved the ball from being stolen and then just went in for an open dunk. I mean, the actual steal itself that he got was good, but he was 4 out of 10 in this game, did have 8 rebounds in his 25 minutes. 4 turnovers and 5 fouls.
And 3 steals,
10
somehow.
Points. Yeah, 10 points on 11 shooting possessions, one block shot.
One thing that struck me with this, the announcers were talking about how they liked the fit of Derek Williams and Kyle O'Quinn, and this is kind of what I was getting at with my little side piece before, is that I think that Porzingis is a really nice fit for O'Quinn, too, because you can let O'Quinn do the dirty work and handle the more physical backup fives, and then you can, so in those matchups, because very few teams have a 4 and a 5 defensive or offensively on their second unit that you really have to think about, so it would shield him a little bit, and I don't think you want to protect him from everything. You want him to get that experience, but I think that would be a nice way to start.
Anything else on the Knicks? I guess Carmelo we should talk about. He was 10 out of 27. Off to a really rough shooting start to the season. He was 4 out of 16 yesterday. 0-7 on threes. Actually got to the rim for 13 shot attempts. He only made 7 of them. He's never actually been that great of a finisher at the rim, and you would expect that that's going to continue to decline. Only 5 free throw attempts out of 27 shots, which is a really bad ratio as well. So I don't know. I'm still, he had some nice performances in the preseason, but wasn't getting to the basket or the line at all. And that's kind of continued in these first couple of games. So I'm still, I still got some skepticism that he is going to get back to being, one of these amazing offensive players quite yet, given the age and the injury situation. And there's talk about maybe trading him, but there is a possibility it could get to the point where he actually is looking like a negative contract about halfway through the season if he doesn't really show that he's back. I mean, because that contract was always going to be bad the last couple of years.
And there's a huge component of this that everybody thinks that he would want to go to a contender, and his value changes on a contender more than anywhere else, because the contracts that you have to give up to get him for most of those teams are generally you're going to be taking away good players. And so you're going to, if you have a very different calculus if you are in the playoffs or even in the title picture. We've talked about the Rockets before, and I think that's where it gets even harder. And if he's only going to waive it to go to a situation like that, I think it gets even less likely that there's a team that's going to follow all over themselves to get him.
Yeah, well, that's probably getting a little bit ahead of ourselves here. Let's talk about Atlanta in this game. Tim Hardaway, now, I have not heard a report of an injury with him. He was inactive in game one and got a DNP CD in this game. And Lamar Patterson, actually, who was undrafted. Was he undrafted or was he a second
round
pick?
He was a second round pick that got stashed for a year. He went to Pitt.
Oh, is that right?
I believe so. I believe
where did he play last year?
I don't remember. It was somewhere in Europe. Yeah, he went to Pitt. I believe he was drafted in 2014, and I think there was something like, we don't have a spot for you right now, and then they brought him back into camp, and he made the team. And you can make an argument right now that he should be their fifth starter.
Yeah, that's true. Bazemore, he probably doesn't know the system that well, but yeah, Patterson can shoot the ball, get to the basket a little bit. He's got a little bit more heft than Bazemore does, so we'll see. Seth was tweeting, like, over under how long before he becomes the fifth starter, but we'll see. I mean, Cephalosha didn't play at all today either for rest coming off of his injury. So I still predict he'll probably end up being the fifth starter at some point. I'll believe that Bazemore is an NBA quality rotation guy, big minutes, you know, more than 10 or 15 minutes a game guy when I see it. Although I've always wanted to believe in him, but you know, you can't really do that, unfortunately.
Bazemore, my issue with it is he's not a three. I think naturally he's a defensive one that shouldn't run an offense. And so, you know, that's a hard spot to be, but he's a little bit more versatile than that. But people have always talked about the spot next to Kyle Korver as being a three, but I think you don't want to do it against the Kevin Durants of the world. But I think that Korver can handle both swingman positions. So if it's somebody who's a little bit more of a two, I think that's fine as well. You just want to get the player who makes the best lineup with all those guys.
Yeah, he's big enough to defend threes. You know, if it's LeBron or if it's KD or even Carmelo, you know, you can't put Korver on a guy like that. But he is bigger than people kind of realize. I think defensively he is more of a three than two. He's just in great shape, and so he can kind of chase guys around. It's funny how the great shooters a lot of times always just get assigned the role of chasing around their opposite number as well. But maybe you could say J.J. Redick actually is really good at that too. He, going back to when he chased around Ray Allen in that 09 playoff series between Boston and Orlando. So maybe the thinking is, and maybe it's true, that guys with that kind of mentality, that kind of fitness, are just good at chasing around guys who do the same thing as them on offense.
Yeah, that definitely could be. And with some of another guy I wanted to mention this. First of all, Al Horford attempted 5 threes, made 2 of them. His stroke looked solid to me. And then also
2 above the break threes.
2 above the break threes. Robin Lopez, I didn't think a lot of his looks were great, but they just kept on going in. And I'm somebody who's liked him for a long time. And if he can,
he's got a really nice touch with both hands, and his short jump shot is pretty good as well.
Yeah, I mean they're going in, and he's, you know, he had a nice run with Portland, and it would be great for the Knicks if he could be a reliable contributor for this team, whether he plays 21 minutes like he did tonight or whether he plays 28.
Well, and he did have a very nice matchup against this Hawks team as well, with a huge size advantage. Lopez is big, just like his brother, and so the huge size advantage on Horford in the post, and that was one thing the Hawks didn't do a great job cleaning up the defensive glass. It looks like so far at least Splitter has not helped them that much with that. That could be a continued bugaboo for them, but they at least got back on track. Teague completely roasted all the guys who tried to guard him. Schroeder did a little bit as well, although Schroeder continued his pattern of good box score stats, bad plus minus, which, you know, we'll have to kind of keep an eye on as well through this year. But that's about all I got on this game. You got anything else?
No, that's it.
All right, before we move on to the rest of the news and the games, let's talk to you about SeatGeek. They are the best ticket sales place on the web. You can download the app within about a minute or so, and it essentially aggregates hundreds of ticket buying sites all at your fingertips on your phone. Once you get signed up, it's basically two clicks to buy a ticket. None of the whole enter the squiggly lines, CAPTCHA, prove you're not a robot, etc., etc. It's all right there, super easy. They have a feature called Deal Score, which ranks every ticket on the market 1 to 100 value-wise. And it plots the best deals on a color-coded map so you can identify the best ticket values. You can be sure that you are getting the best tickets. You don't have to stress out that you didn't go to this site, you didn't go to that site, etc. So, and the best part is, with this code from the Dunked On Podcast, CAPSPACE, all one word, you can remember that easily because we talk about that all the time on the show, you can get a $20 rebate off of your first SeatGeek purchase. So it takes less than a minute to download the app. Great way to support the podcast and buy yourself some cheap tickets.
You ready to move on to Pacers Grizzlies?
Yes, I am. You know, this is, I thought, the best game of the night. I had not seen either of these teams. Memphis got destroyed last night, couldn't score at all. The Pacers lost a tough one in Toronto. And probably the biggest thing about this was that Indiana, whenever Zach Randolph was in the game, decided that they were going to match up big with him, and that put Jordan Hill on the floor, LaVoy Allen on the floor, and, you know, I didn't think they did too well with that because they couldn't stop Memphis anyway.
Exactly. When you're trying to make a move like that, you're hoping for a trade-off, and you're hoping to, you know, you're giving something up to get something, and I don't know what they were necessarily getting from it, because as you pointed out, and I think a couple other people did as well, with the way that the Pacers lineup is constructed, they have a backcourt primarily of George Hill and Monte Ellis. they need shooting from the three, and Paul George can do some of that, but that's where CJ Miles has value on this team.
Yeah, it doesn't help when you want him to have the ball in his hands as the primary creator.
Exactly. So CJ Miles was 4 of 6 from three in this game. Budinger was 2 of 3. You know, those guys can do that, and so you would ideally, I mean, it would be nice to have that at the, two guard as well, but if you can't do that, then you create a team that is so defendable, especially when the other team has Tony Allen.
Yeah, you know, it's going to end up in kind of a bunch of Jordan Hill mid-rangers. Jan Mahimi actually had a great game in this game. He drove to the basket a couple of times in
he had a drive-in kick to George Hill that was beautiful that didn't count because George Hill stepped out of bounds, and the whole sequence just blew my mind.
Miles Turner in 18 minutes had a nice debut. He was +3, 8 points, 4 fouls, of course, because he's a rookie center, and that's just what happens. But he had a couple of nice step-back Jays in the first half. The way I would defend him, and Porzingis for that matter, is if I'm the opposing big and he catches the ball facing the basket, like there are a few times where they're sort of laying a couple of steps off. There's just no reason to do that with either of those guys. They're not going to drive past you. Just get right in their face. You can basically do that with no negative consequences. And the only shot they're going to be able to hit really is, you know, that standstill jumper. And so you might as well just get so close to them that they can't even bring the ball up in front of you and release over your head. That's an aside. The most troubling thing for me about the Pacers in this game, Monte Ellis, 3 out of 12. He is at the age where he should really be declining. I think that a lot of what he was able to do over the last 2 years, and because remember, that signing when they signed him to $8 million a year for 3 years in Dallas was totally mocked. And they had the right idea because they knew that with Dirk setting the screen for him, he could just blow right on into the basket most of the time. And he was also going to be their primary guy handling the ball most of the time. Now, though, I think you have two arguably superior players in George Hill and Paul George who have to eat on this team. And Monte, now 3 of 12 in 32 minutes, he was negative 21. CJ Miles, I think, is a much better fit with the rest of those guys, and he had 18 points on 9 shooting possessions. He was awesome. He's a really, really good shooter. He's a 40% three-point shooter. And then the biggest problem, as we talked about, when you go big, is that you take Miles out of that starting lineup who gives them a ton of space. And then you saw the Pacers kind of struggle a little bit, and of course, Ellis is just a complete disaster on defense.
And yeah, and it would be different if he was a disaster on defense and you had Roy Hibbert and David West manning the interior, but when that's Jan Mahinmi and Jordan Hill or Jan Mahinmi and Paul George, that's going to be a problem. And George Hill is a very good defender. I think he gets the credit he deserves on that end. But the Pacers are going to have trouble beating people because they'll have their good nights. They have talent, but there isn't a fit, and I like Miles Turner, but I don't particularly like him at the four, at least not right now. So it's hard to really think of a way other than that Miles George lineup that allows them to beat strong teams.
Yeah, I think there's talent here. I think they can get to be something, but
they're not terrible in any way.
He's going to have to do some mixing and matching. I feel like also, you know, when they had Hill on Zach Randolph, and Zach Randolph didn't really do much, and part of that was because they were doubling a lot. And my thinking is, if you're going to double-team somebody, why even bother putting in a defensive player who could do a better job, if not a good enough job, to actually not have to double one-on-one? Why not just put in a better offensive player? If your plan is to double anyway, you might as well, and put in someone who's a little smaller and quicker, you just double. You know, you might get hurt on the glass a little bit by someone like Randolph, but I feel like that's better. Why even care how good the guy is who's guarding him within reason if you're going to double team anyway?
We are in firm agreement on this. I think that it's the sacrifice thing. If you're giving up the flexibility that you get with a double team, then you might as well do it for a good reason.
Yeah, and Jordan Hill is just not a good enough help defender. I mean, he's sort of a 4.5. He's always been that in his career, but he doesn't really protect the rim enough. Not really a good enough finisher inside, not like a great pick and roll guy either. It's just sort of mid-range jumpers on offense and kind of wave at guys on defense a lot of times. So I still think that Solomon Hill should ultimately have a role on this team. He hasn't played at all in the first two games. He had a terrible summer league, but I think that with him, if he could just hit some threes, he should get a look at least to see whether he can be a really sort of Draymond Green light type of guy. You know, we say that about a lot of guys. That might be the new vogue. But give him a shot in that role and see if maybe that works a little bit better. Granted, Zach Randolph is a tough matchup when you're trying to play small. But, you know, I think that's, if you're going to play small, you got to commit to it. You know, they always committed back when it was big. We're never going to downsize. Well, if now you believe in playing small, at least give it a shot to play small. I mean, I think CJ Miles could outscore someone like Zach Randolph from the three-point line, because that's who CJ Miles would have had to guard. Of course, Paul George didn't do anything in this game because Tony Allen just ended his life.
Yeah, Tony Allen was spectacular like he is in those circumstances. And the other guy that I wanted to single out for Memphis, they had a lot of players who did well, was Brandon Wright. It feels like he can get pick-and-roll chemistry with anybody who's good at that. And he already had – there were already some nice passes with him and Mike Conley. And what's nice about Memphis is they have him – they have Conley and Bano. And so they have players who can run that all the time. And when Brandon Wright's playing the five, he just – he has a little bit of a quickness advantage. And he knows exactly how to succeed offensively. And I really like the fit.
Quick hitters. Jeff Green – much maligned, was actually plus 14 in this game, and Tony Allen was minus 7, despite the fact that Tony did a great job on Paul George, and Green didn't do as good of a job. But when you go 5 of 6, 2 of 2 on 3s for Jeff Green, that makes up for a lot of ills. And then Beno Udrić was also excellent as the backup point guard. He was 5 out of 6, 13 points in this game as well. I don't have a lot on that late game, that Clippers-Dallas game.
Dallas just isn't
because
there.
Dallas didn't bring their real team. Yeah, Wes Matthews sat out. D. Will sat out after that kind of small knee injury that supposedly isn't anything yesterday that actually looked pretty scary at first. But
well, can I just read Dallas's starting lineup just so we have it for the record? Raymond Felton, John Jenkins, Jeremy Evans, Dirk Nowitzki, Zaza Pachulia.
Yeah, I turned the game. We're actually recording as that game is ending right now, but I turned it off when the Clippers got up by 23 with like 9 minutes left. Jenkins was negative 31 at that point.
He's at negative 24
cannot
now.
Guard. He cannot guard J.J. Redick. You know, he had a nice preseason, and you know, maybe once they get their whole team together, he might be able to give them a few minutes off the bench in a gunner role when he's not matched up with someone as threatening as Redick. But you know, we saw why Atlanta declined his rookie option and refused to play him in the playoffs, even when, you know, they didn't have a single healthy wing, essentially. I mean, they didn't bring their real team. Dwight Powell, who is a player who could be okay, he's got to hit his jump shot. He didn't. And I thought the Clips actually had some pretty good success once they finally started switching on Dirk as well, because he was actually... Dallas was actually killing them for a period when Dirk usually comes back in sort of for his like middle stint there at the end of the first quarter and beginning of the second, or same thing in the second half. You know, their miserable guards were getting right to the basket and doing a lot of work because they were sticking to Dirk in the pick and roll. And then I think when they kind of got away from that a little bit, they were able to start holding Dallas down and kind of making Dirk beat them, which he did okay, but he ended up 6 out of 15 ultimately.
Yeah, there was a lot of switching by Blake Griffin, which is something you don't see very often, and I thought he did a pretty good job holding his own.
Yeah. Also, remember when the Clippers were going to start Wes Johnson? That's thankfully did not happen.
Yeah, even though I'm horribly missing Lance Stephenson on this Clippers second unit, because it could reach another level of magnificent.
Yeah, you know, I tweeted out when Marv said, oh, there's 5 new Clippers coming in, as, oh, here's another one at Doc's all bench units. And then, of course, those guys completely broke the game open. So I'll happily eat crow on that one. Also, that Chris Paul sham god on the baseline.
Amazing.
Who did he get with that? I forget.
Was it Jenkins? I don't remember. I don't remember.
I think
it was
a big dude.
It was. And then not only was the sham god great, but the layup afterwards wasn't a blind bank, but it was like a pretty clean reverse bank, and it was just beautiful. He's such a talented player.
Yeah, although actually someone told me once that that's not a sham god, so if someone wants to correct me on Twitter, please do. That sort of like fake crossover, but then spin the ball back into your original hand to move.
Somebody called it a yo-yo. I saw that. I don't know if that's...
Yeah, you know what? Maybe that is what it's actually called, and that actually makes more sense. The Sham God, I think, is the, like...
The in and out with the same hand. I think that's the core part. I'm not... Well, some
no,
a listener will comment. I am sure of it, and we
all right. Let's move on. Neither of us can do it. How about that?
The other thing I want to mention is Mark Spear has reported that Chandler Parsons is hoping to play on Sunday, which means that the Mavericks could be getting closer to getting whole, and that's the part of this when we can actually start analyzing this team.
Yeah, but on the other hand, this tonight's team is the team that I thought they were going to have for a while, and it's good that Wes is back. He actually looked good the other night. Parsons, who knows how good he's going to look when he comes back, but I think there's still going to be a lot of these nights where they're going to get maintenance. Those guys might be playing 20 minutes a game, and when they're not there, and no D-Will either, that doesn't help much either. So, all right, one other news piece before we get into the Facebook mailbag. Demo and Terrence Jones not going to be extending per Shams Charania of Yahoo Sports. I wrote that piece on Nylon Calculus saying that basically, again, it's a lot about 2017, I think, but Daryl Morey always wants to have his flexibility. And also, if Dwight Howard leaves, then the fact that they did or didn't extend them either way could end up being a concern.
It makes complete sense. It makes more sense for the Rockets with these guys than I think it does for the Warriors, just because their flexibility is a little bit more important in the near term, and it's awfully hard to calibrate the value on these two guys as well.
Yeah, and you don't even know which one is better yet. So it's hard to say that we want to commit to one of these guys or the other, which probably for your long-term planning, neither of these guys yet is a guy who you know is going to be an above-average starting power forward. And so if you're going to extend both of them, even if you say you could do that for a combined $20 million to have 20, or I'm sorry, not 20, $25 million, which probably isn't realistic, or maybe $30 million would be, but to have that much sunk into a power forward position and still maybe not even have an above average starter, that's a pretty big risk to take. Now, now that they have not extended them, if you keep their cap holds on the books and Howard leaves, you can get up to about $17 million in space, and then maybe if they moved on from Corey Brewer, they could get to max space as well next summer, and that's before extending them. And then also, if you only keep one of them, I think they basically have, right now without them on the books, they have about $35 million not committed, assuming that Howard were to extend for about what he's making now, which I think is somewhat realistic. Maybe he'll demand more, but you'd have about $35 million to work with in 2017, absent having signed one of those guys. So those are sort of what the stakes are. But there's also, now there's a lot of restricted free agents going on there, and the more restricted free agents that come onto the scene next summer, then the better decision is to let more of them become restricted free agents, because then there's more competition for those guys.
And that also pushes back the timeline for potentially when they could be signing offer sheets, though it is a long moratorium, which means that when you have a player like these two with low cap holds, that means you have a little bit longer to make all your magic work.
That's right, yeah. They cannot sign until July 12th. You noted that it was a long moratorium this year. I looked it up. Oh, that's going to be agonizing next summer, that to wait 12 days for anyone to actually sign. But yeah, I mean, we saw this year, pretty much everyone important, except for like Aldridge and DeAndre, had signed like by the end of July 1st, or at least agreed. So if they're not going to agree to new contracts with the Rockets by July 1st, then you're twisting out there in the wind until you can officially sign an offer sheet, and no team that's going to sign them to an offer sheet is going to let it get out until they actually sign them, so I mean, maybe you would have that agreement in principle, then you just don't tell anyone about it. But anyway, it's, I think the restricted market may be a little bit more chilled than people initially thought that it was, but there's so much space around the league. Maybe some teams will just say, hey, we didn't get our initial target. There's only five guys worth spending a max contract on. Let's just wait and see what happens. We'll, we'll make three restricted free agent offer sheets if we have to, and we'll just wait until the middle of July.
I think they'll get their money, but it'll take some time, and that is always scary because the longer you wait, the more you give teams time to fall in love with somebody else. I mean, the best example of this might even be the Sacramento Kings. Like, the Sacramento Kings could have been a team that would have given a more competitive offer to one of the guys they got, but they had already filled up their books by the time it got around, even though they didn't get the space until July 1st.
Yeah, and maybe what we're going to see for a lot of these, too, is guys not getting offer sheets, going into the whole, hey, I'm going to sign the qualifying offer. No, I'm really going to sign the qualifying offer now dance that we saw with Bledsoe and Thompson, because if, in fact, the cap is going to go up to 108 in 2017, which we don't know is going to happen because we could have a whole new labor agreement by that point, then there's going to be just as much free agency money out there, and they'll be totally unrestricted if they're not getting, you know, a really good deal. But we'll see. You know, they could be at the point where you say, all right, you know, if you're going to pay me eight figures, that's still life-changing money, I'll take it. So we'll see. You know, a lot of these teams are really prizing their flexibility for next summer, especially the good teams.
And some of these players have the bad fortune of being in teams where them signing the offer sheet gives those teams actual flexibility next summer. So if they're sitting there and they go, yeah, you know, there's the downside risk that you could leave, but having you at, you know, $5 million or less next year helps us so much.
The other thing that's interesting too is the guys who are on teams that aren't that great or aren't necessarily traditional free agent destinations, makes more sense to extend those guys, right? And even in the case of Valanciunas, they started him at about $14.5 million. That only actually cost them really about $3 million in cap space, talking about the Raptors. But a team like Charlotte, yeah, go ahead and sign me up, because, you know, it's not like you're going to be using your $40 million in cap space or whatever is next summer very efficiently in a non-free agent destination. So is there anyone left? I guess Fournier is really the only guy left, I think, that we're really have much of a chance. So you got the guys on the Celtics, Terrence Ross, maybe. I don't see any of those guys happening because the Celtics hope to be a player next summer, and Ross probably, they aren't even offering him a contract as big as his $8.8 million cap hold next year. So
you're not holding your breath for the Dion Waiters extension?
Oh yeah, you know, I guess that's, you know, that wouldn't be impossible.
And Myers Leonard's possible too.
Yeah, that's another one of the, you know, I can never remember a year in which we've had just so little talk about where guys even are, what they're looking for, or anything in the media. So I would imagine usually you have some sort of understanding, like, hey, they're working on it. There'll be some kind of a report about what the offers were. You know, if there is a real offer that's made, it usually gets out there, and that has not been the case so far.
Well, yeah, and I wanted to reiterate a little bit on a point you made about Valanciunas, and this is actually true with Michael K. Gilchrist. Before we got the numbers on him, it was going to be possible that he was actually going to have a lower cap number for next year with the agreement. It ended up being, with the way they structured it, it was a little bit higher, but those teams didn't have the same choice that the Wizards have with Bradley Beal, that the Warriors have with Barnes, or that the Rockets have with their guys. So they have a different circumstance, and as you said, the marketability is an important factor too. The other guy we should mention is Terrence Ross. There's a possibility there too.
Yeah, no, I mentioned him.
Oh, I
didn't
hear.
I don't think it's going to happen. He's got a maybe I misspoke and said Terrence Ross, but I meant Terrence Ross. He's the $8.8 million cap hold, and it's hard to imagine that the Raptors are offering him a salary that starts at that much. So that's why I don't necessarily expect anything to get done. All right, you ready for some Facebook questions?
Yeah, you want me to start with a question?
Please do.
Okay, so this is from Josh Ackerman. He asked it specifically to you, so I thought it'd be appropriate to ask first. It says, Nate, it seems like you feel in almost every situation that teams should be playing what used to be threes as fours and fours as fives. Is there a context where you believe that in going big, or do you always feel that spacing and shooting is better?
That would be the general principle, that I think spacing and shooting is better. Part of that is because I really believe in switching as a defensive strategy. I've really come around to that, because you just simply prevent the offense from getting that initial opening that causes help. And just the shot that you're going to get one-on-one, even if it's a guard against a big, unless it's Steph Curry or some other guy who's going to drain a three in the guy's eye, that shot is oftentimes going to be a long two-point jumper, and that's probably a worse shot than you're going to get a lot of times when you're in a situation where an opening has been created by a screen and you have to give help, and then you can get a guy wide open. So that's a big part of it. I like the ability to switch more. I like the ability to shoot more, because simply opening up more for others, even if the players in question aren't as good of basketball players. You know, this is sort of the David Lee, Draymond Green thing, right? Like, David Lee is a more skilled basketball player than Draymond Green is, you know, offensively, certainly. But when you consider the – and then we're talking about just offense here right now. But when you consider the effect that Green's ability to shoot the three-pointer has on his teammates, overall your offense functions better with a guy like Green than with a guy like Lee, who when he doesn't have the ball is kind of gumming up the works for everyone else. Now, if your bigs are just way better than your smalls, then yeah, you probably should go big. Like, Memphis shouldn't be taking Zach Randolph off the floor because he's one of their best players and has been for a long time, and he provides them with a unique advantage. But how many, especially with the new rules now where you can help more, how many teams really can punish guys on the interior, both on offensive rebounds, which have kind of been de-emphasized for the sake of transition defense, and on post-ups? There aren't really that many of those guys, and so it's just easier for small to beat big than big to beat small, and that's why I like that philosophy a little bit better in most circumstances, but of course it's all personnel dependent.
Yeah, it's personnel dependent, and Tristan Thompson...
And there are a lot of teams, I should add this too, there are a lot of teams whose wings just aren't good enough to play small.
Yeah, I agree with that. And there are certain wings that just don't have the right skill set, the right fit to do it. But again, it also can be situation dependent, which is something we've talked about before. Like, there are more fours now with guys like we've talked about with Brian Anderson in his current athletic state that you can defend with a traditional three without those ill effects.
Yeah, that's right. And another thing too is, part of why I believe that this theory is proven correct, at least with the current rules and the current environment, if you look at some of the teams that go small, if you'd say, all right, is, you know, guy X a better four than guy Y is a three? A lot of times, I think there are probably more fours to go around just in terms of like depth at the position than there are threes. But yet you still see teams oftentimes trying to play small, and the reason for that is just everything kind of works better in the macro than when you have two bigs traditionally playing together.
Yeah. Do you want to go?
All right. Should I do one here?
If Let's, you have one you like.
How do you guys generally watch games on nights with a ton of games? Do you pick a few, switch between, et cetera? This is from Colin Miller.
For me, it depends a little bit on what's going on, but I generally like to have one game in the early stretch that is my primary. And so, as an example, on the big day that we had yesterday, I watched a lot of, in the beginning part of the Orlando-Washington game. It was the only game on early, and I kind of fell in love with that game. And then I have a secondary for when it's on break. But then, once it gets a little bit more wide open, I try to still have a primary, but then if something gets good, I jump over. And then also with the ability that we have now to watch plays or watch a lot more after the fact, I feel a lot more comfortable now settling on a smaller number of games than I used to be able to.
Yeah, that's true. I think now I haven't told anyone this yet, but I actually am now using this podcast and my writing as my primary source of income. I actually left the law firm, so I have a lot more time to watch games than I used to. Back when I was at the firm and, you know, I was probably really only able to watch games three nights a week, I would just watch whatever entertained me, basically. And then if I felt like I hadn't watched enough of one team in a while, I might change that up and try to watch more. Now I have two TVs, and I'll usually try to watch a game in the morning when I'm at home, you know, just quick, try to bang it out in an hour or so. And then, you know, that's one of last night's games. And then during the game watching, I'll usually have, you know, two games that I'm really watching. One that's kind of the primary, but then the one that's not the primary, that TV, I'll probably be switching around a lot to kind of whatever game's closest. If a game gets down to the end, I'll kind of want to see that aspect of it. But usually I will just, especially this year when I feel like last year I didn't have quite as good of a handle on some of the bad East teams because I would be at work until like 6:30 p.m. On the Pacific Coast and then come back. So I didn't get to see those teams nearly as much as I would have liked. So now I think I will try and make sure that I'm watching, you know, at least one game of each team every two and a half weeks or so.
Yeah, and one thing that I'll mention is part of, for me now, I try to do more planning on it. I try to be more strategic because I try to say, like, oh, this is a good representative or not representative time to see X player. You know, so like tomorrow, Jahlil Okafor, Rudy Gobert, I'm just intrigued to see how that works out. So I'm going to try to maybe make sure that I see a stretch of that. And that actually is where the non-national games of the week piece, which is now migrated to the Sporting News and is now called the League Pass Alert piece. It's a weekly thing that I do about the best games that aren't on national TV. And how that started was I was doing that for myself. It was something that I was just doing to look at it and to kind of think about, okay, well, who do you want to see what days? And then I just decided, I was talking to my boss at Real GM and just said, would you be interested in running this? And generally people really like it. And that's how it started for me was it was my prep.
All right, we got two New Orleans Noel questions here. The first one from Danny Marks is very easy. Who's a better shot at averaging two blocks and two steals a game this year, New Orleans Noel or Kawhi? The answer is New Orleans because I can't think of any perimeter player who has averaged two blocks a game. I mean, I think there's only maybe like five, six players who averaged more than two blocks a game last year. So Kawhi is not going to average two blocks a game. New Orleans, I mean, people have been talking about the fact that he could maybe average two steals a game. I think he's a pretty good shot for the blocks at least, and he's one of the best steals big men, you know, really if he continues at this pace ever, if he can keep that up. So I think it's definitely New Orleans. On this one from Will Foy, regarding a redraft of the 2013 draft class, he's basically saying the general consensus is that Gobert and Giannis are one of those two guys would go first, and most people are leaning towards Gobert. Why is Noel seemingly discounted in these discussions? And in the case of Gobert, is rim protection that valuable, or does Gobert project to have other skills? I'll let you start off on that one.
Okay, so first things first, I have Noel second. I think that Giannis, as much as we are tantalized by his potential, it is still potential at this point. And so I would take Noel second. I would take Rudy first. But what makes...
Oh, so you would take... You like Noel over Giannis,
yes,
huh?
Right now, absolutely. And and so I the reason, but I'll go into the main part, which is why Rudy's number one. And as the person who has caved for Rudy Gobert the longest of anybody I know, the reason for it is that he is an elite rim protector. According to Nylon Calculus's rim protection, he was, I believe, the single best guy in the league last year. Depends on which number you're using, but he's also a really good rebounder. And so what you have there is you have an overall defensive profile of somebody who isn't taking the risks, who's actually impacting the shots, and is also ending possessions. And offensively, I think there's a lot more to him than we've seen so far and that we can. I thought he was a nice pick and roll guy, not amazing, you know, not anything like that, but good enough to be respected on that end. And also, he's a good offensive rebounder. So I think that he can be a game-changing defender who you don't have to make the same offensive sacrifices that you do with somebody else.
Yeah, he's showed some growth in his passing last year, and he could have a lot more of a Tyson Chandler. I wouldn't go quite as far as DeAndre Jordan, because DeAndre Jordan might be like the best alley-oop finishing center ever. But we would see more of that if Gobert weren't playing alongside a traditional big like Favors as much. Or if there were more room, he could probably get a lot more alley-oop finishes. He is pretty terrible at finishing in any situation other than that, though.
Yep.
Especially if he's got contact up against him on like an offensive rebound or a deep post up or something. Like he's one of these guys. Porzingis suffers from this too, where if a guy is on him, he'll just throw some shot up off the backboard because he gets knocked off balance and just, you know, doesn't quite have the strength. So I think I probably would put Gobert still at number one in that group, especially because he already is the most valuable of those guys, I think. Although maybe, and Noel, the only reason that I worry about him as being like a real star is he's probably a little bit too thin to be a full-time center a lot of the time. And he's never, I don't think, going to have the jump shot to really be that good of a shooter at the four. He's not going to be, he'll always be a below average shooter for the four. So if you're going to play him defensively, I think he's a monster defensively in a lot of situations. You're still going to be making some sacrifices offensively, or you're going to just kind of get bludgeoned a little bit, because I don't think he's ever going to get up to being more than like, you know, maybe 235 or so weight wise. And then Giannis, I would have Giannis above Noel as well. One reason is health, that Noel still was red flagged by a lot of teams, and he's been good so far, but it's always concerning that, and you would worry that maybe that comes into play in a couple of years. I don't want to speculate, but something that has to be priced in. And then Giannis, he basically, when he entered the league, we have the age limit now, but he was basically a high schooler.
Yep.
Right? Like, he was almost the exact same age as LeBron James when LeBron entered the league. So I think he just has a little bit more upside, and then his ability, basically, at some point, he's going to be someone who can switch through all five positions pretty seamlessly. And if he develops his three-point shot, he's a pretty good passer. You know, I think I don't see him as a great one-on-one scorer, ultimately, but he can be a guy who, you know, very easily can be someone who's at least average or above at pretty much every major skill.
Yeah, the stat that I would point out there, I don't have the exact number, but I think Giannis is younger than something like a third of the guys who were drafted in the first round in 2015.
Oh, yeah, that wouldn't shock me at all. All right, this is a good one from Christopher Hartig. What NBA greats of the past do you think would be particularly well-suited for the pace and space era? David Robinson comes to mind for me.
The first guy I thought of, and I still really like it, is somebody who has kind of not spoken against it, but Charles Barkley. I think Barkley in a Draymond Green-style role would just be...
Oh, hell no. No way. Barkley could never defend. He doesn't have the length that Green had. He's not even as tall as Green was either. Doesn't have the ability to move his feet out on the perimeter and switch. Barkley would be a total defensive liability.
Okay. Who do you think of?
I'm sorry to be so harsh on that,
no,
but
you can,
Barkley was renowned as a terrible defender.
Yeah, well, I was thinking of it more on the offensive and the fact that they're encouraging now power forwards to do something that he already did, which was...
Well, he also wasn't a good three-point shooter. He was, like, one of the worst three-point shooters, volume three-point shooters in NBA history.
Yeah,
I don't know. I actually think he still would have been a great player, but I think he would have kind of been, like, Blake Griffin, but worse defensively, and but that's kind of how I would think of him, which is still a very good player, to be sure. And maybe not as good of a passer as Griffin, since Griffin's an amazing passer. But yeah, I think Barkley would not. I think he would be worse under the current rules because it's just harder to back guys down. That's how he got a lot of his points.
That's a great point. I hadn't put that piece in it.
And I'm not sure that he would have really been that good in the pick and roll. Although I would have to think about that a little bit more. But that's not something that he did a lot, but that's not something the whole league did a lot. Let me think of some candidates myself while you come up with with a better one.
what's hard about it is, like, a lot of people have pointed to basically guys who were jump shooting bigs before this era, and there's something, but I think what you're looking for is something that's a little bit more versatile, I think, and that is harder to find in other eras.
Yeah, that might be true too. Jerry West would be one. Pete Maravich actually was another one that Seth and I were talking about on Twitter the other day, what he would be like in the modern era. But I think Jerry West would be, you know, he could be like almost like a Steph Curry type of player today with the type of shot that he had. I'm sure he could easily stretch his shot out to the three-point line, no problem. And let's see, I mean, David Robinson is a really good one, by the
absolutely.
Way.
Yeah, absolutely. That kind of took me out of it a little bit, because I think, yeah, and I was thinking of it more in terms of bigs, just because I maybe it was the David Robinson part of it that tilted me in that direction, but you're right, Jerry West is a great one. I've actually thought about that before.
Let me see if I can come up with one more here. This might be a little weird to some people, but Shaq?
Yeah.
I think Shaq... Although the rules are a little bit more conducive to defending post-ups, when you consider that you could play a four-out system around him and just let him post up right under the basket, and you're either giving up, now you're giving up a three, or you're letting him beat you, yeah, that's I think he could be pretty good. You know, he might struggle defensively, especially later in his career some, but I think he would be so unstoppable on offense, especially because there are less big centers than there used to be as well. I think that he might be just as dominant, if not more dominant. And also pick and roll is something that he could have been really good at and was probably underutilized in his career, especially in his LA days.
Yeah, that's a great pick. I think that's well better than I could do, obviously.
Well, that's right. I think I'm more of like a history guy than
you. Oh, you certainly are.
Watching like ESPN Classic. All right, we got time for one more here. I think this is a good one. Justin Heath, of the year two players, which would you expect to make the biggest leap from year one to two, and which sophomores will disappoint or even regress?
So the biggest jump, I think one of the guys that we've already seen, Aaron Gordon, I think is getting to the point where I think he can do a lot better. Marcus Smart, you and I are both really high on him. I think that he could do a really nice step there. In terms of disappoint, I think you correct me if you disagree with this. I think that's more about guys not improving as much as we hoped. And Zach LaVine is a possibility there, just because, you know, especially if they're using him at point guard. That's just, as we talked about last night, that's not something that he should do. And another guy who I really like, that I think it's more about opportunity than anything else, is I'm a big Rodney Hood guy. I think that he could play a really nice role with this team. I think that he's a talented player, and that I think is more about opportunity than about personal growth and skill, but I really like him and think he could do well this year.
Some of the guys sort of fall into the category of they were so bad last year that they have to improve. Gary Harris would be one. Doug McDermott would be one. Capella, I can't believe you didn't mention Capella.
I didn't want to go on a cliche, man. Everybody knows I love Clint Capella. I gave up driving his bandwagon to Kevin Pelton, but I'm still on board. I'm controlling the music. That's what we agreed on.
All right. So here are some that I think may disappoint a little bit. I think Wiggins could be one. I've talked about that a little bit before, where I think this could kind of be a consolidation year for him, especially because people are kind of thinking, all right, you know, he's the next superstar. You know, could he get into all-star consideration or something like that this year? I don't know about that. I still think that he, you know, may end up kind of more of a second best player on a really good team level, which obviously is still great than best player, but he exceeded my expectations last year, and maybe I'll be proven wrong. Smart, I would certainly agree with you as a positive guy. Maybe Elfrid Payton and Yusuf Nurkic. Nurkic, because he's coming off the injury especially, might be guys who disappoint a little bit, although Payton's jumper did look better. So maybe that one game isn't enough to sway my opinion, but there's some thought for it. All right, I think that's probably about all I got.
What do you think about Jordan Clarkson?
Oh, yeah, I didn't even scroll down that low. No, I think he'll do about what people expect from him this year, which is quite a bit considering he was the 46th pick last year. And I haven't seen, I mean, he looks very impressive physically. He's pretty good at getting to the basket. I mean, if he does disappoint, I think it's just because like Kobe is taking all of his shots and Lou Williams and Nick Young and whoever else.
There are a lot of guys in the 20s of this draft that really have a lot to prove this year. You have Jordan Adams, who hasn't done much, PJ Harrison, who actually started in the game, and then a guy who wasn't in the 20s but played less than the guys in the 20s, James Young. I like James Young going in, but he was so raw then, and he seems like he's still raw now.
Inactive in the Celtics' first game, and that was even, I think, with RJ Hunter being ill.
Mm-hmm.
That's looking like it might be a strikeout there. All right, that's all we got. You got anything to plug at all before we go?
I wrote a piece yesterday for Sporting News about the importance of ownership being willing to spend, and used Utah as an example, not being critical of their ownership, but how they need to understand where they are now because they're going to have to pay all of the guys on their team more in the future.
Yeah, although they do deserve credit. I'm sure you noted this. I haven't read the piece yet, for buying that pick for Gobert.
I didn't use it as a criticism of them. Basically, it was about like these are the decisions they're going to have to make, and they just need to be candid about where they're going with it because they have something like $20-30 million to spend next summer if they want to. But if you spend anywhere close to that on players, then you're going to start pushing into maybe even the tax once you have to pay all these guys what they're going to deserve in the new cap climate.
Yeah, that's a very good point. All right, so if you'd like to support the podcast, I told you about SeatGeek today. Using that cap space code, all one word, can help support the podcast and keep them sponsoring the show, which would be great. The Facebook page, which some of the guys who did questions today left questions on. Mine is Nate Duncan NBA. You can keep up with my articles there. Yours is Danny LaRue or Danny LaRue NBA?
Danny LaRue NBA on Facebook.
And then I'm Nate Duncan NBA on Twitter. Danny is Danny LaRue. Also, if you want to leave us an iTunes comment or ranking, that is really helpful. That's actually been one of the keys to the success of the show. I mean, if you look at kind of some of the other shows that have been around the same amount of time or even longer amounts of time than our show has been, our number of reviews to amount of time that we have been out is spectacular, and we really appreciate the support there. All right, that's it. I think we will talk to y'all on Sunday night. Till then.